Today we welcome Australian young adult fantasy writer Michael Pryor, author of 38 books including Gap Year in Ghost Town, the book we chat about today. Michael has had 7 books recognised as CBCA notables and shortlisted for many literary awards. Today we chat about the fantasy genre, the writing process and ghost hunting. If you enjoy this episode, check out our back catalogue where we interview some incredible authors including Longmire's Craig Johnson, Jackie French, Will Kostakis, Jack Heath, Kate Forsyth, James Fahey, Tristan Banks and Tim Harris.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Welcome to the podcast, Michael. It's a real pleasure to speak to you today.
It's great to be here, Daddy.
We'll largely be talking about Gap Year in Ghost Town. It's the book, your latest book, and a book I really enjoyed. And congratulations on the recent news that it's going to be a sequel in 2019.
Yeah, it's a terrific thing. It's a vote of confidence from publishers, for a start. But because I write mostly fantasy and science fiction, when I write a book, I do a lot of creating this unusual world with all of its specialties. And often I get to the end of one book and I think there are more stories waiting to be told in this world. And that certainly goes for Gap Year and Ghost Town.
Yeah, I would agree. Did you always intend it to be a series?
Yeah, I fully feel that there are a number of stories. I've got a major story arc all worked out, ready for 2 or 3 books. And each of the books have worked out their internal arcs. But it's a commercial decision from publishers that if they feel that there's not enough interest out there, they'll say, yeah, just one book, thanks. And then I'm always prepared for that, sadly. And so I can work to make each book a standalone, if that's how it turns out in the end.
The characters are so interesting, especially, you know, not just Anton, although he's quite interesting, the other characters as well. So I think there's so much you can do and so much more we can learn about those other characters in the novel.
Character is everything, Danny. The more I write it, this is my 38th book.
I know.
The more I realise that any character carries the whole narrative, that if a writer, a creator can come up with characters that are engaging and interesting and complex and three-dimensional, readers are interested. I mean, we are hardwired. Humans are interested in other humans, what they do and how they're going to behave and interact with each other. We're fascinated by that, and it works in fiction. That the characters have their own lives and their own backgrounds and their own motivations, and sometimes I feel like I'm just documenting them as they go about their adventures.
And it's interesting you say that, because your book is about supernatural, it's about ghosts, and yet there is a real human element to it, you know, the loss and the grief and the friendship that the characters feel. So it's an interesting balance that you've had to create.
Yeah, again, that's something that I've come to over the years of writing, that I love the fantasy aspect of all my stories, that the made up, the imaginative, the outre and the outrageous. But they're nothing if they're not underpinned with real human interactions and people going about their lives. And so it's really odd that that the more one writes fantasy, the more realistic one tries to make the people in it. And especially that idea of family. I mean, if people ask me, what is Gap Year and Ghost Town about? I don't say it's about gap years or ghost towns. I say it's about family. And it's about family and it's about friends. And every intricate combination of those two vital aspects of humanity, you know, are worth exploring. And exploring them while there's a lot of ghost hunting going on, that's okay too.
Can you tell us anything about the upcoming book? Is there any secrets you can reveal, or is it all hush-hush?
It is a little bit hush-hush. There's a lot of talk going on between me and my editor, that Alan and Unwin. I will just say there are some surprises that should be shocks and should be completely stunning, but they are well seeded in book one.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of references, a number of little asides, a number of little things that are definitely planted there that that shoot and sprout in book two.
Interesting. I'm going to have to go back through my notes and make some predictions.
Yeah, that's great. But it's one of the things we always do when we read. I think we make predictions that, oh, I bet this is going to happen. Oh, I'm sure he and she are going to go off and do that. Yeah, we do that all the time. Part of the fun of reading.
Absolutely. One of my favourite things about the novel was the uniqueness of Anton's voice. It sounded like, to me, you were having a really good time writing his character. Can you take us through the process of creating him?
Glad you've highlighted that, because I see Gap Year and Goat Town, it's what I call a real voice novel.
Mm-hmm.
It is almost like someone is standing there and talking to you. He's not writing down his words. It's very verbal in that way. And that was deliberate. It was one of the things I wanted to do. 38 novels. This is the first time I've written a first-person narrative.
Wow.
In all my other novels, I've been very comfortable with writing third-person narratives, third-person limited, and they're great. I've enjoyed that. It's been really terrific. But as always, one tries, challenges oneself with a new book, and it just came to me that, yeah, 37, maybe I should try a completely different narrative mode, and that's the first person. And I'd written about two or three paragraphs, and I said, where have you been all my life? Why haven't I done this earlier? And it is, having said that, that it was so joyful, very almost straight away, it takes a time to nail that voice.
Mm-hmm.
That business of how a 17, 18-year-old young man would talk and the sorts of vernacular, the sorts of phrases he would use. Look, I've got my copy right here in my hand here, Danny. Let me read to you the first paragraph of chapter 2 of Gap Year and Ghost Town. And there are a couple of phrases in here that I deliberately, before I started writing, I said, I'm going to use these. These are going to be Antonisms. They're going to be part of his standard speech mode. So it starts like this. You might think that ghost hunting is full of glamour and excitement, international jet setting, hobnobbing with world leaders, and stuff like that. Well, yeah, nah. Ghost hunting is more about mud and cold and waiting around for something to manifest. So there are two giveaways there. One is the yeah, nah. That's a verbal mannerism. People don't write that. That's something you say. And so that's why I wanted to get that in. I think twice or three times through the novel he uses that particular construction. And the other one is where he tails off his sentences. And he goes, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, and stuff like that. And that is an Antonism too. And again, I made a list of these before I began. I said, this young guy, he's going to talk like that. He's going to use stuff a lot. He's going to use words like things. He's going to be a bit inexact about stuff. But that's the sort of guy he is. He doesn't know everything, and he's a little bit vague about some stuff. And I imagine there are some 17-year-olds who are a little bit vague about things, and that was the guy I wanted. And he's relatively confident, but unconfident in other areas. He's a bit of a smart aleck. He knows that, and he's got a generally optimistic view on life. I didn't want him to be a brooding, angsty YA teen male. He's an okay guy. I'd like to meet him. I think he'd be a nice guy to have a cup of coffee with.
As a high school teacher myself, I thought you nailed the voice. I thought it was very authentic, but also really unique and exactly, you know, that presence. And also the pop culture references, the Lannisters, for example.
And again, that's his milieu. I mean, that's the sort of world he lives in,
yeah,
where he doesn't have to think about those references. They're just at his fingertip because he swims in it all the time. And he loves that sort of stuff. And it's also a touchstone for his friend. If he references the Lannisters, the other, yep, we know exactly what you mean. You don't have to have a long, involved explanations. Yep, you've got it in one, just with a pop culture reference. And that's the way he does it. His voice developed momentum after a chapter or two, and I always feel it's around about 7,000 or 8,000 words into a book before I get that feeling of voice. And And he did. He just took off in lots of ways. And he talked to me. He talked to me all through it. And I got the words down.
And just touching on that point where you said you just found the voice after 7,000 words, I think that's a really important statement, especially for students who are learning how to write, that you can't really just do a 1,000-word draft and think, oh, you know, I've nailed it. It really does take drafts and drafts and thousands of words to really get into that character's head, doesn't it?
Reworking and repolishing and understanding that that the first 5, 7, 10,000 words of a first draft might end up in the bin.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to go through that. In a way, you've sort of got to get that out of your system before you can get into the good stuff. And for me, it is also about momentum. The more I do, it can be a slow start, but as I get a handle on who these characters are and what their reactions would be in certain situations, it gets easier and easier. But you've got to get over that hump at the beginning. And once the characters, when I'm writing dialogue, and Anton says this, and I say, well, yeah, well, of course, Rani would say that. And then if she said that, well, naturally, Anton would come back with this. And it just unfolds almost by itself because the characters have been grounded in all sorts of things that we've worked through up until that point.
And speaking of dialogue, I read one of your tweets that said you can't make dialogue realistic because it's full of ums and ahs and stops and starts, but you have to make it real. So how's your process for making dialogue? Because I know dialogue can be a problem for a lot of writers.
Yeah, and there is a really subtle difference between realistic and real. Real, it would be just recording what people say, and that's the tweet mentioned. There's stops and starts and pauses and mumbles and all sorts of stuff. Realistic is faking it so that people read it and think, yeah, that's real, but it's not real at all. It's a close approximation, and it leaves out all of the stumbles and bits and pieces. But I think one of the most important things to try to get right in making speech realistic is rhythm, mm-hmm. is the rhythm of sentences. How we speak sentences when we're talking to people is very different from how we would write a sentence on screen or on paper. And it's got a lot to do with the balance, the first part of the sentence, then there's a pause which would be indicated by a comma, then the second part of the sentence. Some people, their characteristic way of speaking in dialogue, they might tail off at the end. Other people might have very blunt or staccato sentences. And each one of these different rhythmic devices helps to denote which character is who. And the staccato character will be staccato all the way through, and the other characters won't be. It's a differentiation device, getting that sort of thing. And then there's vocabulary, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You try to get the sort of vocabulary, as I was saying with Anton earlier. He says stuff like that and things and yeah, nah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's just contemporary speech. And I mean, you hoover a lot of this up by talking. I mentioned earlier to you, Danny, that I was visiting a school today. Visiting schools are research for me too. I'm listening carefully to how young people are talking. I'm taking notes, I'm making mental notes, things that are striking, and also just testing stuff out. I'll sort of say things and watch their faces, and if they roll their eyes, I think, okay, nope, that one's passé, I won't be using that. And just checking out the reaction, like that sort of thing. So it's really important for me to get out and visit schools and visit young people. Keep that tone right.
So if you're a teenager, your conversation might end up in a book if you're around.
100% there's a chance. And the other thing I like doing is checking names, because names change so quickly, and you can use dated names in a book, and suddenly it's not contemporary anymore. Your book is almost historical. But so I'm always looking at roles and looking at the names written, scrawled on the front of people's pencil cases and books, and I will take some of them, and they may well pop up in a book.
That's fantastic. All the kids that you've visited at schools before are now going to go back through your books and see if they can find themselves.
Yes, and there are occasionally I've thanked a couple of particular kids at a particular school because I stole their names.
That's a great tribute, I think. I also loved the quirky female characters, Beck, and how comfortable she was with her fake eyeball. I loved that. And Rani, a sword-fighting ghost hunter with an Aston Martin. How did these characters emerge? They were wonderful.
I'm glad to hear that again. I really like my characters in all of my books. Even the evil ones I have some sort of affection for. But these people doing stuff, making decisions, organising their lives, doing a whole lot of growing up, sorting each other out with the usual sort of mixture of confidence and awkwardness that people of this age have. I get to like them very, very quickly. And those three people, they're friends. I mean, Anton and Beck are friends that go back a long way, and Rani comes into this circle, and there's some friction to begin with, but certainly by the end of the book, and I don't think this is spoilery in any way, yeah, they're fast friends. And with three, I have to differentiate them. So again, in preparing to write, I made lists of, you know, this is Rani style speak, these are the sorts of words, this is her background, this is how she will talk and behave. Anton, here's his list, Beck is her list. And to differentiate between them, you often go for obvious physical aspects. Well, we've got two females, one male. One is the height, their build, all sorts of things like that. And just in trying to make them individuals, I had this feeling with Beck that I did want to, I did somehow want to have her with an aspect of her physical being that was unusual. She's got one eye, and she basically got a glass eye. But searching for the words here, I wanted to normalize it. I didn't want this to be at the forefront of the story or the forefront of who she was. The book is not Beck and her glass eye. Beck is a character who gets involved with these adventures. And as she says at one stage, she tells Anton off, this is not who I am. I do all of these things, and I just happen to have this this artificial eye. And so it's just a background item. Yep, it's an aspect of who she is. And of course, once I made that decision, I went through all sorts of possibilities of what could happen and how she could be differentiated like that. And once I decided on the idea of an artificial eye, I had to do research on exactly what does that mean. And I got in touch with a man in Melbourne here whose job is making artificial eyes.
Wow.
And I didn't know this, but you do it by hand. He paints the eye.
Wow.
So everyone is individual, everyone is different, and he will try to match it up with your existing eye. So it's all done with these incredibly fine paintbrushes to get the slight blood vessels that appear in the white of your eye, and to get all of the shades of colour. It's an extraordinary job. But he was very, very helpful, very polite in giving me background in all of that business and how you take care of these things and the pluses and minuses. And so that became part of who Beck was.
I love that. I love how I've learned something new and unusual on every podcast.
Well, that's part of the fun of writing. Yeah. Research is wonderful and can be quite seductive sometimes. Sometimes I have to tell myself, stop researching and get on with writing the book, Michael. But Rani, I knew Rani was going to be the sort of Anton's opposite. She was had to be from a more military background, a more aggressive and violent approach to ghost hunting. And again, this was deliberate. This is one of the really early things I had, even before I'd worked out who the characters were. I knew that he was going to be from a more gentle and humane ghost hunting background, and she was going to be more violent and aggressive. And so essentially I'm gender flipping those sorts of characteristics around there, and I just thought that made a nice little tension to keep the story off, especially.
Yeah, I liked that. And going back to the glass eye, I liked the subtlety of that, because all teenagers will think there's something unusual about them or be self-conscious about something. And because it wasn't an issue, it was who she was, and she was awesome. I think it, well, I hope it sort of gives teenagers the fact that it's okay to be a bit different. It's fine. You can still be great and wonderful and have friends and be accepted and liked. So I liked that element of it.
100% that if there are messages in every book, that and that is certainly one of the things that I endorse, this idea that, yeah, well, we are all different, we all have things about us, but that's not who we are. That isn't that shouldn't limit us and shouldn't define us. We are so much more than one aspect. I've got a very good friend of mine I've known for many, many years, and he has one arm. And I remember the first time I met him, and it was immediate. You notice he's a guy with one arm, and he doesn't have a hand. And now, after the 20 years of knowing him, I don't even notice it. And I will offer him things with both hands, and he will just slap me around a bit. You forgot again, didn't you? Yes, I forgot again. He's not the guy with one arm anymore. He's just my friend.
Yeah, that's nice. And the novel touches on several serious issues, which I thought could either be ignored by the reader and they could just keep reading, or they could be explored depending on how deeply, you know, you wanted to think about the novel, which I liked. And you touch on life after death and its uncertainty and easing ghosts into an unknown passage. Was it your intention to have readers think beyond the enjoyment of the novel?
Yeah, always. As you say, that stuff is there. But I didn't want to make it an issues book, a Hallmark movie of the week, which is about a big issue. I have trouble with that sort of approach to writing, that especially for young people, the feeling that books need to be about something serious in order to improve young people. It's that didactic approach to especially young people's literature, I think, is really dire. I would much rather do what I'm doing here. There's a story, there's characters, there's things happening, and there's stuff there. There is stuff there, because part of being human is thinking about all sorts of things, and if I can raise them, as people would, and especially if they're involved in this sort of a business of ghost hunting, raise them and they will talk about them. And if someone who reads that book then, as you say, want to take it further, or it prompts them to start talking to somebody else, yeah, that's absolutely fine. And I think that's the way a lot of good fiction works, that it you can springboard out of it into all sorts of areas. Books that make you think and make you feel, yeah, they've really got something good going on there.
And you also touch on some cultural references, and I like that you acknowledge that, and I found it particularly interesting. And in the novel you suggest, or your character does, that perhaps we are attuned to our own death rituals and locked out of others, and that different traditions spawn different beliefs. And for example, Anton had said he'd never seen an Aboriginal ghost, and I thought that was really interesting, acknowledging other people's cultures and beliefs.
Oh, I really worked hard on that one. That troubled me. I wrote my first draft and there was no mention of that. And I thought, I'm setting this book in Australia, in an Australian city, and to not acknowledge that absence would be wrong and would be cheating in lots of ways. And that's what's great to have Anton as a character, because he questions things. He questions things and he doesn't have answers, and he's quite happy to admit, I just don't know. And again, talking about real and realistic, I think that is a realistic attitude for a young person to have. I don't know the answers. I'm quite happy to discuss them and think about them. But in the end, I can shrug the shoulders and say, I'll have to find out or talk to other people, or maybe it's just going to be in that basket of unsolvable mysteries. And this business of death and cultural rituals and how we perceive afterlife or not is one of those things that, yes, he's thinking about, he's thought about, and he is prepared to go on thinking about.
And sometimes Anton can be wise. You know, sometimes he does ask more questions and, you know, made me think about more things as well. But he can also be quite wise. And he says it's the hammer problem, you know, as she's taking on, you know, the violent kind of way of easing the ghosts. And he says, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And I thought, how clever is that?
Anton is a smart guy. I mean, I like smart characters. I have trouble with characters in books who are just not very intelligent. intelligence is enabling in all sorts of ways. It's a way to chart your own course, a way to solve problems, it's a way to make sense of the world around you. And so all of the characters, Beck and Rani and Anton, Anton's dad, all of the characters are smart in one way or another. And yep, Anton has been brought up in a household of smartness. There's books around, his dad's smart, his dad's researchers, his whole family background is about heritage and history and theory about ghost hunting. So he's heard these discussions all his life. He's been brought up that way. And it means that, yes, sometimes he is wise. Sometimes he's got a really good handle on things. And then, like a 17-year-old boy, he'll turn around 5 minutes later and trip over his own feet. yep. Again, I reckon that's realistic too.
Absolutely. Now, this novel was a departure for you in many ways as well. We've talked about, you know, the first novel in first person, but it was also the first book that you've read that wasn't set in the past or in an imaginary land. And Melbourne was really quite important in this novel as well. Why the departure in this novel?
Again, like writing in the first person, it was a bit of a challenge to do something a bit different from what I'd been doing. It's one of the ways I think writers keep fresh, is to change mode, change approach, change attitude of a book after writing in a particular way for a while. And it did occur to me as the first bit that I hadn't said anything in contemporary Australia, and this is the city I live in, and I really love Melbourne. It's a great city to live in, and I thought, right, let's use that. Let's use my own warmth and knowledge of this place, and see if I can imbue a book with that. So in lots of ways, I said the book is about family. It's also a book about Melbourne. It's a bit of an homage, a tribute to a really interesting city in all sorts of ways. We name check specific landmarks, places a lot of people know, and then a whole lot of lesser known places and haunts around the place. So that it's... And the more I wrote like that, it was a bit tentative at the beginning. The more I wrote, the more I got into it, and being able to just drag in little details of Melbourne streetscapes and how you get from A to B, instead of having to make up how many leagues it was from this imaginary city to another city. Yeah, I know how far it is from one suburb of Melbourne to another suburb. And that was, yeah, it just made me smile to be able to do that.
You could almost do a gap year in Ghost Town city tour and take all the people that have read the book into all the little landmarks and a little tour of Melbourne.
Interestingly, I have actually sat down and worked out a ghost walk.
Oh, really?
Where I could well take a bunch of people around to a number of the places that Anton and Rani and Beck go to in Gap Year and Ghost Town. And because ghosts in the book, they go back many years, it's also a historical tour. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about research earlier. Yep, I had to do a little bit of research on some of these places and the stories that are there already. Wonderful to work with.
Well, if this happens, please let me know. I'm going to come down from Sydney because I'll need to go on this tour. It sounds amazing.
I will. You will hear about it.
Fantastic. Now, I had to look up, and I don't even know if I'm saying this right because I couldn't find how to pronounce it on the internet, but phasmaturgist. Did I just murder that word?
No, phasmaturgist, phasmaturgy. I made it up, basically.
Did you?
The first part, Phasma, is ghosts. Actually, I can't remember. Is it
Greek? Well, it said something. Yeah, it said something on the internet about, you know, the study of ghosts, but then I tried to figure out how to pronounce it, and it wasn't there. And so I was wondering what kind of research you had to undergo for a ghost book.
Well, there is a lot of research. Plenty of ghost stories and ghost hunting stories. Mm-hmm. And that last part of that word, that turgy, is a fairly standard fantasy sort of word about magic using. That's essentially what it means. And so if I plug in the first part of Phasma, which is ghost, and turgy, it's ghost magic. That's mm-hmm. what the word comes to mean like that. But I did research, and I looked up various... And it's surprising how quickly people get very, very serious about this. Really serious, as in thinking, yes, we can talk to ghosts and stuff like that. And, I didn't want to go down that route. So I was looking more at classic literature, ghost stories from Victorian era. People like Arthur Conan Doyle, the Sherlock Holmes guy, he wrote a number of ghost stories. And the way that they had very British ghosts got me thinking about, maybe there are other ways to think about these sorts of things. And then the notion of where do ghosts go, where do they come from, and what spawns ghosts, and are ghosts us? And I didn't want to go there. Painful things about that for me. So I had to basically invent a whole new system of ghosts and where they come from and how they're generated and what they mean. And so, that was just me. That was just invention.
Which I think is good. I think you have room to invent and, new ideas about ghosts and what we don't know. So,
yeah, very much so. And once we start to I chart the course in that direction, it means we're doing something a bit new and a bit fresh, and it opens all sorts of doors for me in terms of narrative and stories and possibility, but for people just to start thinking about things. I love imagination. I think imagination, plug that into intelligence and you've got something really powerful going on for everybody.
And you say that character is everything, and you've written 38 books. Does your characters drive your stories, or do you plot at the same time? What's your writing process, and has it changed throughout each book?
Yeah, my writing process for the first few books was a lot of fumbling and trial and error, but my process is bedded down fairly well for some time. And I am a planner. I do plan, and I do a lot of preparation, as I mentioned, a bit of research. I compile sort of character profiles. I try to get an idea of who they are, and as I said, the vocabulary they use, and even things like their favourite item of clothing, that sort of thing, to make them distinctive to me before I start writing. And after a while, characters, I have to have a sense of the location, whether it's a real location like Melbourne or imaginary location. If it's an imaginary location, it can even mean things like sketching maps and getting some sense of the landscape. And I will do that for some time, and eventually I sit down and I write myself a point form outline, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, right down to the very last thing that happens in the story. I'm a big fan of knowing where my story is going to go before I start writing, and especially a sense of what is the final scene? Who is the final scene of this story? Who's there? Where are they? What do they look like? How have they changed from the opening scene of the novel? And if I've got the last scene and some sense of the first scene, then I can fill in between and all of the outline events. And when I say outline, it is outline. There's plenty of room to move. As I begin writing my first draft, I have that plan, that outline with me, and I follow it, and then occasionally take sidetracks, and then get back to it, and until I finally get the first draft done. But I am a planner, and I did try once writing without a plan, and I didn't get very far. sort of going around in circles, and I didn't have a sense of direction, so no, I fall back on the plan.
No, I often hear that writers write that final scene. How often does the final scene change from your initial plan after you write, or has it always stayed pretty much the same?
I'd give it about a 50-50.
Okay.
And I'm prepared to change. Mm-hmm. In the early days, once I started, when I was planning, I tended to be a bit more rigorous. I tended to ignore things that came up along the way. Now I'm quite happy to listen to characters who basically have suggested that what they should do next is quite different from my plan. And if that takes me a long way away and we end up somewhere else, that's all right too. If it's grown organically out of their character's background and their wants and desires and their personality, it's worthwhile, and it will create a better story than my sort of cold outlining at the very beginning. But I need, the outline is my safety net. Mm-hmm. It's there. I know that if I followed it to the letter, I would get something done. But along the way, serendipity happens, and even characters pop out of nowhere that I've planned these things. I know who the main characters are, the secondary and tertiary characters, who they are, and then suddenly I just need somebody to point out direction, standing on a street corner, and half an hour later, she's turned into this wisecracking, really knowledgeable, useful person who joins the main characters, and they go off together. And that just sometimes happens.
It must be wonderful that even after writing so many books, you can still surprise yourself and find yourself in that situation.
There are a number of things that I like to do when I'm writing. One of them is to complete the work. But the other is to surprise myself, as you said, to challenge myself, and to abuse myself. I do like to laugh at my own jokes, because I feel at least that joke has got one appreciative audience if I laugh at it.
And I think that is great advice for all writers. So all those student writers out there, I think that's some great advice right there.
That's one of the things, that the book, as well as being scary and spooky, is a funny book.
It is. It's really joyful to read.
Thanks. It is meant to be like that, partly because I feel there is a lot of very serious and very worthwhile books out there, but for young adults, especially for older teenagers, there aren't as many funny books as I would like.
Mm-hmm.
And funniness or silliness or lightness is often undervalued, I believe, out there. And so I wanted to make sure that there was a bit of fun, a bit of banter, a bit of snarky comments, and a bit of silliness involved.
And that just captures teenagers, doesn't it? They are silly and they are joyful, and that's what's so wonderful about them.
It's one of their default ways of interacting. Out in the yard, in the classroom, they joke with each other. They make fun of each other. They go backwards and forwards. It always surprises me when teenagers sit down to write, all of that vanishes. They try to write very serious, partly because kids, by and large, want to do the right thing. And they do tend to imagine that teachers and parents and grown-up, they want serious stuff to do it properly. And all of that fun and the cleverness, language cleverness that they use out in the corridor suddenly disappears. And I'm always encouraging them to go back to that. Write stories where you make fun of yourself. I think Australians in particular like that. It shows that you're not too full of yourself. And it's an easy mode for young people to write in. My advice then is do it more.
Yeah, I like that. I'm going to try that in my own classrooms. I think that's a great idea. Now, before we say goodbye, I just want to ask you, I see on your Twitter account lots of tweets about food, and I've noticed from speaking to countless authors now that authors also have a passion for food. Why do you think food and writing is so interlinked?
Yeah, look, part of what we do when we write is try to recreate a sensorium. Yeah, I'm getting technical. Sensorium is the way we experience the world. There's a psychological term, and it means we filter the world through our senses. And our sense of sight, naturally, is the dominant one. We get so much of the world, so much of our world experience through there. But writers, we often push into the other senses. We'll describe hearing, we'll describe the sense of touch. But smell and taste are very, very powerful ways of helping a narrative recreate an experience so that the reader can step into that world because they're smelling that world, they're tasting that world. And so basically I'm saying that all the food I eat and all the food I cook is just research. That's all it is. But it is that sense. I like to think that as writers we try to experience the world in that sort of sensory complexity, and so we can write about worlds with sensory complexity, which makes it easier for a reader to immerse themselves in there. They can experience the world that the main character is experiencing. And as writers, we're making that easier by providing some of those sensory details. I was talking to young people the other day about the sense of smell and how powerful a trigger that could be.
Mm-hmm.
And one smell in particular that I used as an example is the smell of blackout, of sunscreen. That every time I smell that, it takes me back 20 years to when my daughters were tiny and beach holidays, and when you'd have to slather them in blackout, otherwise their thin little skin would just crisp up. And it's just that distinctive smell. And if I apply blackout today, bang, I'm immediately back in that world of little kids and beach holidays and sand and seagulls and surf. It's a powerful trigger. Smell, taste is the same. Tastes from long ago, it can take me to different countries if I taste them today. They can take me back years if I taste them today. And I think writers, we tend to revel in stuff like that, tastes and smells and those sort of things.
Well, that's one of the best answers I've ever heard, and I'm definitely using that word again, sensorium. That's wonderful. I really like that. Well, I love what you wrote on Twitter as well. We all want to be part of a story, either as a creator or as an audience. It makes us part. It's part of what makes us human, and I thought that was so beautifully said because I think that is so true, and that's why stories resonate with us and have resonated with us before we even wrote them down and they were told, you know, in verbal circles. So I think that's a lot of truth in that.
It's part of what makes us human. We, as humans, we want to make meaning because it's our way of exerting a little bit of control over a universe that is often chaotic and without meaning. And storytelling is our primal expression of that. And it might come from that need to make meaning, but it's more than that. It's enjoyable. We love it. You look at the faces of young kids when they're having a book read to them. And they're being transported somewhere else by the power of narrative. And it's a great and glorious thing, and I never get tired of it.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I love reading aloud to kids too. It's just a different experience for everyone, isn't it?
But one thing, you've got to do the voices.
That's the best part.
Different voices for that character. And sometimes that gets to be a real challenge for reading out loud. But you do it, you do your best. And kids, it's interesting, even little kids are quite forgiving. if you mess up a little bit, they understand, and that's the way we go again.
And it brings back that silliness, doesn't it? If you're not afraid to do the silly voices and all the different accents, then you're bringing that silliness and joy back into the classroom.
Very, very much so. And I have found that even older students, upper high school students, they love every story read to them. They will listen to a story being read to them. Something serious, something important, something enlightening, or something silly. And again, it turns reading from being that solitary experience to be a shared experience.
Yeah, like storytelling should be or has been throughout history.
You could look at that experience of in the classroom, the teacher reading to a group of people, it could go back thousands of years, you can imagine people sitting in the cave around mm-hmm. the fire and one person telling the story of the mammoth hunt and how it all went terribly wrong and everybody came home hungry and tired and bruised and thrashed. But geez, it was a good story.
Well, I have learnt so many new things today and I'm sure our listeners have as well. Thank you so much for your time, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you and getting inside your brain and how you develop your books and characters. So thank you so much. It's been really wonderful.
Anytime, Danny. And I must say that every time I do something like this, I always learn stuff as well because you've got me thinking and that's a great thing.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.